The download is complete.
Welcome to the AV Forums podcast, presented by Phil Hinton.
Hello and welcome to December's Home Cinema Podcast. Coming up, we look back at the year and our favourite products. So joining me on the Home Cinema Podcast, the last one of 2012, is Steve Withers, Russell Williams, Ed Selly and Mark Hodgkinson. Good evening, guys.
Evening, Phil.
Evening, Phil.
So we're going to kick off by discussing last month's podcast, and the reasons for that is that there were two interviews. So if you haven't heard it yet, I would go and download it. It is interesting. We have Guy Hawley from Dolby and Brian Claypool from Barco. And they were discussing two new surround formats that are coming to the cinema next year. One is Dolby Atmos and the other one is Oro 11.1. So I guess we need to talk about the Dolby one first, Steve, because you were lucky enough to be invited along to Witten Bassett, the Dolby facility there. You met up with Guy, this was after the podcast, and you were given a demonstration of Atmos in action. So tell us all about it.
Yes, that's right, Phil, because luckily I live about 20 minutes from Witten Bassett, which is where Dolby have a major facility where they basically organise all their cinema installations for Europe, I think. So Guy very kindly invited me down to take a look, because I think when listening to the podcast, when you try to explain Dolby Atmos, it's quite difficult initially to understand it, because it's a very different approach to doing cinema sound. And it's one of those things that's difficult to explain, but very easy to understand once you actually sit there in a cinema and hear it. And the way that Dolby Atmos works is it actually uses what they call objects, which are individual sounds, rather than just using channels. So theoretically, you could have up to 128 separate sounds, or if you want to be traditional about it, separate channels even, within a single Dolby Atmos soundtrack. So I went along to their facility. They've got a big cinema there, which they use for screenings and that sort of stuff, and quality control, things like that. It's called Screen One, not very original name, but that's what it's called. And they had that cinema set up for Dolby Atmos. So what that basically means is there are speakers going along the sides, which is as you would normally see in a cinema, but these speakers start right at the front by the screen and go all the way along the side, on both sides, and all the way along the back. And then there's also two arrays of speakers going over you, overhead. So you've got overhead and side, all the way from the screen, all the way to the back. And the first thing that they played for me was just a guy with a guitar, playing his guitar and literally walking around you. It's a 5.1 mix, so they played it initially in 5.1. And of course, you get that sort of bit of a gap as he moves from the front left to the side or rear left. Basically, even though there was a full array of speakers, and obviously this is an Atmos-equipped cinema, so it's going to sound better than a lot of other cinemas, even with the 5.1 mix. But you did hear a bit of a gap, because obviously he's moving from one channel to the next. They then played it to me in Dolby Atmos, where it had been remixed into Dolby Atmos with additional objects, and it's a completely smooth transition. The guy basically just walks around you with no gaps whatsoever. It's quite amazing. Then they played me a demo, or more like a trailer, really, a trailer for Dolby Atmos. It's called Rain, I think. And it's basically rain hitting what would be a tin roof above you. And honestly, it was totally immersive. It was like you were sitting in a tin shack with it pouring down with rain all around you and above you. Really quite impressive. They had a trailer that was mixed by the guy who mixed the soundtracks for the Transformers movies. So it was very similar, lots of that kind of sort of mechanical, robot-y sounds. But he actually did a complete objects-only mix. So it wasn't a 7.1 mix, it wasn't a 5.1 mix, it was objects-only. In other words, he took advantage of all 128 objects. And there's a little screen on the desk where I was sat in the sweet spot of the cinema, and you could see the room modelled in a wireframe, and then it showed you the normal channels plus where all the objects were being moved around the room, and this was just a mass of objects. It was just a totally, totally immersive. It was a completely different experience. I've never experienced anything like it in a cinema, to be honest. And then they took some actual film soundtracks, which had been remixed into Dolby Atmos. So the one that was particularly impressive was Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where they played it to me with just the objects playing. So not the 7.1 bed, as they call it, but the actual objects. So, again, you just heard sound effects like bullet hits, bullet shots, roars, this sort of stuff. Then they played it back with the soundtrack, and you realize how the designer was using the objects to emphasize certain elements of the soundtrack. So you could still watch it in 7.1, you know, and enjoy it. But it just made it all that more. I mean, there's a bit where a helicopter flies over your head, and it literally goes, the sound goes over your head, and it was just incredible. And then they showed me a clip from Taken 2, which is one of the first films after Brave to actually have a Dolby Atmos soundtrack. And there they used it quite intelligently, because there's a scene where Liam Neeson's character gets kidnapped, and he's got a black bag over his head, but he's listening to audio clues so he can work out where he's being taken to. And whenever the camera sort of cuts to his face, him listening, suddenly the Atmos track bursts into life. So you could actually see it on the display. You could see on the computer screen the 7.1 mix just being used. And then suddenly the Atmos track would kick in, when it was just surrounding him with these different sounds that he's listening to and the different audio cues. And that's kind of a creative way of using Atmos and taking it beyond just a standard 7.1 mix. I'm really grateful to Guy for you know, showing me around the facility. It was absolutely fascinating for anyone who's interested in cinema sound. And definitely, having had a demonstration, I'm really looking forward to the only cinema at the moment in the UK that's got Dolby Atmos is the Empire in Leicester Square. But they're showing as of tomorrow, they'll be showing, that's as of the 13th of December, they'll be showing The Hobbit in Dolby Atmos. So anyone who wants to go and experience The Hobbit, which will be the third film mixed in Dolby Atmos, then go along to the Empire Square if you can. It'll certainly be worth it. It really is the most immersive cinema sound I've ever heard. It was incredible.
The thing that stood out from the interview, and it's interesting to see how it's replicated, did you get any sense, because they were stressing sort of the modular nature of Atmos, that you don't need to go all in with 128. Sort of separate either channels, images, etc. Did you get any sense of how well it scaled from the sort of, you know, a more basic implementation to full fat, all in, everything she's
yes,
got?
Yeah, I did, Ed, because obviously not all the mixers were using, you know, there was the one trailer the guy mixed objects only, if you like, but he just used objects in the entire mix. Which is obviously excessive, and no one would normally do that. Although their ultimate goal is to create what they call a Dolby Atmos workflow, where you do mix totally in objects, and then you basically just, you know, sort of down mix that to a 7.1 or 5.1, what they call bed, from that original objects only mix. That would be the ultimate goal. And the idea, obviously, is to try and make it as efficient and as quick as possible, because obviously in post-production, time is money. And in the moment, Atmos is adding time and cost to mixing your soundtracks, and that's not good. So they want to make it to introduce this workflow where they do it the other way around, and therefore you can have an objects only mix and then drop it down to 7.1 or 5.1 and make it much quicker, much easier, and much faster. What you can do with Dolby Atmos is it actually models the room, and it models the room precisely in terms of the dimensions, obviously, but also in terms of what speakers are in there, exactly where they're positioned. What their capacity, you know, what power handling speakers have got, what applications being used, how many channels, everything. And then what it can do, if you've got less channels available to you than you would ideally like, is that it can actually use DSP to position the objects where they're meant to be within the room, given the number of speakers available to the system. So it's modeling on the fly, basically.
That seems like a very useful feature. And it was, you know, in these, you know, relatively tight financial times, I mean, a cinema can, you know, look at the options available to them. I mean, whilst notionally Atmos has a bigger buy-in if you're going all the way, it struck me as interesting that at this sort of early point in the exercise, you can start with a slightly, they could notionally start with a slightly more bare bones implementation. And as and when the requirement and the interest allows it, they seem to be able to scale it, which seems like a sort of relatively sound piece of thinking, if nothing else, and it's good to hear that it seemingly works that way as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, clearly, if you want the full Atmos experience, the one thing you do need to install are speakers overhead, which is obviously going to be a certain amount of cost attached to that. But it's interesting that their speaker array is literally an array of speakers over your head. From Brian's interview, the impression I got with Oro is that they're more like traditional height speakers that you see in some of the expanded sort of 9.1 and 11.1 soundtracks and on receivers in the domestic market, where they have additional, say with Dolby ProLogic 2Z, it's got two height speakers at the front. Their approach seems to be using height speakers rather than using an array of overhead speakers. So it's a slightly different approach. Plus, their approach is obviously very much channel-based, traditional channels, and Dolby's is not traditional channels at all. In fact, it's a completely different. It really is a quite revolutionary approach to doing cinema sound, in all honesty. However, as you point out, Ed, if you can do that in the cinema, there's no reason why that approach, and it already is being applied by people like DTS and on their Neo X algorithms, you can presumably take that basic approach and do the same thing in the home, where if you had 7 speakers or maybe 9 speakers, you could then use DSP and some sort of domestic version of Dolby Atmos in order to give the impression of having precise effects all around the room.
Now, obviously, that's not something that they're going to do at the moment. I think the one overriding fact that we got from both interviews was that this technology is cinema only, and it's going to be like that for at least the short term anyway, because the whole point of putting this technology in is to get people in to watch films and add a little bit of difference back again between home cinema and going to the cinema.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Phil. Obviously, the whole reason behind both of these formats is to try and make going to the cinema as spectacular and as immersive and as exciting and as completely different as possible from just watching at home. And a lot of people now have got, home cinemas or certainly 5.1 sound systems in their lounges. You know, the difference between the cinema and the domestic setup is getting less and less. 1080p, it's getting very, very good for quite reasonable amounts of money, to be perfectly honest, which I'm sure we'll come on to a bit later on. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Phil. It's just the same as in the 50s when they brought in widescreen and CinemaScope and 3D and just ways of trying to get people away from their TVs and back to the cinema.
It's like it's the same thing as, I wonder in retrospect now if you'll ever see 4K, 2K material in the home, even when the ability to stream it does catch up, precisely because of what somebody said earlier on, which is they want to differentiate what you get in the cinema from what you can actually do in your home.
But you see, I think 4K is more valid for the home because you don't have to put 9, 13, whatever speakers into a room to enjoy 4K. 4K is easier to deliver, I think.
But the thing was, that's one of the things I sort of gleaned from Datasat. I mean, the reason Datasat Holdings bought Datasat or DTS Cinema, Cinema Entertainment or whatever it was, is because it's sort of an in using their core technologies on the satellite side to actually transmitting 4K, 2K signals, massive numbers of channels of sound over satellite or however over networks to cinemas, so people don't ever have the hard copy.
That's already happening, cinemas.
But they were talking about, they were rattling on about sort of other sort of systems of delivery as well.
They can either send it by satellite, and they can send it by internet. They send out caddies. When I was at Dolby, they showed me them. Then they send these out, these basically hard drives.
Yeah, that's right.
Military grade hard drives, that are encrypted.
Yeah.
That they send out to the cinema. And the cinema gets sent a key by email, a series of numbers and letters that gives them the right to play the data on that hard drive for a certain period of time. From a certain date to a certain date. And that's how it works. And that's digital cinema, basically. That's the way it was developed. And the battle that's going on at the moment isn't just for a particular sound system. I mean, the battle is for digital cinema. And the idea, what the cinema owners want is what's called the single imagery solution. Used to be 35mm film. You had a piece of film, and on that piece of film was the image and all the soundtracks. Nice and simple. And that's what they basically want in terms of digital cinema. And at the moment, the company that's probably the most aggressive in terms of delivering that single inventory solution is Sony, because, of course, they control everything from beginning to end. They own a studio, and they develop and they make the cameras, and they make the cinema projectors. So they've apparently been quite aggressive in terms of delivering digital cinema solutions to to cinemas.
Going back to my original point was that I can't really see what's in it for them to start making discs or whatever with these massive soundtracks on it, because that's what brings the bunts into the cinemas in the first place.
That's what Phil said.
Awesome. Yeah.
I mean, I agree. But ultimately, all this technology, I mean, if you think about Dolby Pro Logic, DTS, Dolby Digital, they all started in the cinema. But ultimately, that will filter down to the domestic environment in some form or another. Now, I don't think we're ever going to see Dolby Atmos, the cinema version, at home. And I think that just because, as anyone's would point out, the idea of having two rows of speakers over your head in your lounge, that ain't happening, is it? Let's be honest about it. But I'm sure we'll get something similar in terms of delivery, but using more DSP, I suspect, in order to create phantom speakers.
The thing that sort of worried me, if you like, about the Dolby interview was, I'm sure it was sort of covering all bases, but there was continued reference to how good it sounded outside of the action film staple. Now, I'm sure that that's a very useful thing, but ultimately, it's not necessarily a clincher for the clientele for those films, whether they're going to an Atmos-equipped cinema or not. Whether we like it or not, extremely capable sound systems are, if you like, you know, they live or die on their ability to deliver, you know, cohesive sort of thunderous action. And I can understand with, you know, Dolby's sort of enthusiasm to try and cover more bases and stress how flexible the system is across more film soundtracks. But if you're making a low, you know, a low budget sort of arty sort of film, going back to the South Park classic, gay cowboys eating pudding, I don't know if they're necessarily going to make the effort, as you say, it's a big deal in time and budget to go Atmos. So it just, I don't know. I think they might be spreading themselves a bit thin. It almost certainly is going to live or die on its ability to enhance the summer blockbuster experience. And it's possible, and I guess we'll come to it, as to whether Barco's sort of decision to go all in with DreamWorks might be more practical in that regard.
Possibly, although I've noticed that DreamWorks are fairly agnostic as far as sound systems go, because they've also released Rise of the Guardians in Dolby Atmos. So I think Oro's claims of exclusivity were a bit over the top. The impression I get is that Jeffrey Katzenberg at DreamWorks Animation has expressed a preference for Oro, and they're going to be using Oro on a number of their films, but they've also are experimenting with Dolby Atmos. Conversely, Peter Jackson, for example, has expressed a preference for Atmos and says he thinks it's the way forward, and that's why they've mixed The Hobbit. And I suppose from the point of view of Dolby, they've got the advantage of having three Hobbit movies coming out over the next year and a half, all using Dolby Atmos. But the point you make about using it for other things than just action films, I was given, unfortunately I can't mention the name of the film, but they did give me a demonstration of another film that was remixed, a horror movie using atmospheric effects. It was really, really good, because you think about horror movies particularly, you know, a lot of it is down to the sound design. And if you can have very precise localization of effects, from people, like people walking above you on the floorboards above you, this kind of stuff, it really made it really creepy and immersive in a way that you just don't normally get, even with a really good 7.1 mix. So I think there's lots of potential. Ultimately, it comes down to the creativity of the sound designers and the filmmakers. And I think that's why Dolby have taken the approach of trying to get as many filmmakers and sound designers on board as possible to generate content. The idea being that the content will then push the cinema owners to spend the money to upgrade. That's their approach, rather than upgrading the cinemas and then not having any content to show on or play on it.
It's an interesting point that you made, Ed, and I know where you're coming from with that one. But I think Steve alluded to one of the demos that you had there, which was The Tin Roof in the Rain. And then if you think of films that are not necessarily, you know, action films, the one that comes to mind with Steve mentioning The Rain is something like Seven, a film like that, where you can add so much atmosphere without the audience realizing just where this atmosphere is coming from, just with clever, you know, use of the surrounds to when they're standing in the street and it's pouring the rain and that kind of thing. I think the gist of it is to try and put you in that situation and surround you with the sound, which is obviously what 5.1 and 7.1 were initially designed for. But I like the idea that it's all enveloping, and the more I listen to Steve talking, I really want to hear it.
Oh no, don't get me wrong. I'm particularly enthused about it. I mean, the example that was rattling around in my head is something which has, you know, been wildly successful to cinemas, which was something like The King's Speech. Where, you know, I don't doubt that Atmos would make it better. Where my concerns lie is, would it have attracted, would any clientele have not gone to see it if it didn't have Atmos and it was widely available? And equally, would it have attracted more people because it did have it? It's these sort of interesting films where don't get me wrong, they're not low budget, but neither are they exactly in the no expense spared school of filmmaking. And it's where that sort of comes in that I'd be interested to see what the sort of take up is on it.
If they brought out a technology that made things like the King's Speech sound fantastic, but it had no impact whatsoever on your Transformers movie, nobody's going to install it anywhere.
Well, it's not just that, but I mean, is, I mean, you know, I don't want to drag my mother into this. It's very unfair of me, but I don't. There's a huge clientele for films like that where it, you know, the expense of adding that soundtrack is unlikely to enthuse any of the people that weren't going to see it to go and see it, and it will mean nothing to the people that were already going to see it.
That's a fair point, Ed. That, you know, to a certain extent, there are a lot of films that get made where sound design is not, you know, essential to the story and isn't going to make a big difference to its box office or its appeal. But at the same time, you know, films do have complex sound designs. Even films that may not appear to have complex sound designs probably do. And even something like The King's Speech, where clearly at the end of the film he gives a speech, you know, you're going to have sound effects in terms of giving it a sense of it being within a stadium. I think it was Wembley Stadium, wasn't it, when he gives a speech, or something like that, some big stadium. So, you know, you want to give that atmosphere to it. And what Atmos does, as the name might suggest, is it does give things more sense of three-dimensional atmosphere, more sense of reality. I mean, they played me another trailer again, but it was sort of set within in a forest, where it was, you were surrounded by the sounds of a forest. Now, I've obviously, you know, never been in a sandstorm or been hit by a gigantic robot, but I have been in the rain and I have been in a forest. I live in the countryside, so I know what they sound like. And the sense of realism was quite remarkable. And it made me think of one of my favorite soundtracks this year was actually The Hunger Games, which was a beautiful, subtle, really beautifully designed soundtrack. Particularly when they're in the forest during the actual game itself, you know, there's all these nice little surround effects immersing you in that forest environment. And I kept thinking during that demo how even more immersive that would have felt had it been given, you know, the kind of sort of all-encompassing surround sound that Atmos offers.
I think it's like good special effects, good CGI. If you don't notice it,
yeah,
then it's done its job. And the whole point of a sound mix is not to take you out of the movie. Now, if you've got really obvious panning effects or really over-the-top placement of effects, the risk there, and I mentioned this in the interview, is that you're going to pull the person out of the world that you're trying to create and pull them in to watch the movie. And a really well-mixed movie, you don't actually notice the sound effects because it's drawn you in and you're not paying overly too much attention to what's going on around you, which is the success of a good mix.
That's true, Phil. I think yeah, if it's going boo over your shoulder all the time, then clearly that's just going to be distracting. But like I said, I think a really great mix does immerse you subconsciously, perhaps, in the world it's trying to create in audio terms. So, well, I guess time will tell. I mean, that's the bottom line, isn't it?
I was going to say, is there any information that the Dolby or Barco will be in some way certifying the cinemas that install this? You've heard this in sort of like these reference grade installations where the people who have made it have said this is what it should sound like. But if you actually go and see a DTS 5.1 soundtrack in a DTS room, it sounds fantastic in a way that it never does in a normal cinema, simply because most cinemas are quite frankly substandard in terms of their sound.
But you see, I think even that's starting to change.
It's another case of more, rather than, you know, being better, rather than just better being better.
I think that the cinema in general has made huge leaps and bounds. If you just go back to the late 90s, where things were terrible, and, you know, people weren't taking any kind of interest in presentation and so on. When you've got the threat of people installing home cinemas and people having high definition at home and all the rest of it, These people that run the cinemas, the exhibitors, they have to pull out the stops. They have to make sure that the presentation is absolutely bang on the money and is going to bring people back, because the picture was fantastic, the seats were comfortable, the sound was good. And that's definitely where both Barco and Dolby, certainly from what I took from the interviews, are trying to aim that at the big, large event cinemas. Where you're going to get all the creature comforts, you're going to get the best picture, you're going to get the best sound. Now, interestingly, Odeon have just opened up a new cinema near me at the Metro Centre, and I've been a couple of times now to IMAX screenings. And I've got to say, the best cinema I'd ever heard was in LA, funnily enough, you know, the centre of the movie universe, and you expect the theatre-going experience to be absolutely spot-on, and that was a THX certified cinema. It was one of their showcase cinemas. The one at Gateshead that I've been to recently, I would say the sound was just as good, and the picture was absolutely phenomenal. The seats were nice and comfortable, and that adds so much more enjoyment to the film. Certainly when I think back to the late 90s when I was going to see things like Jurassic Park and they're projecting it on the ceiling because you had one projectionist and 15 screens running at the same time, and you know it would take them 5 minutes to get there to put it back into focus and so on. Because everything's so automated now, I think the exhibitors can really put on a good show now, and this is, I think, where Barco and Dolby are aiming their technology at the big showcase. You know, this is the best presentation you're going to hear and see.
So your local 8-screen multiplex, it's going to be a wall.
It's a case of adapt or die, isn't it? I mean, 70% of cinemas are now digital, and they've had to go that way. And that's only going to get bigger as things go forward. So if exhibitors don't adapt to the marketplace and the demands, and they put on a poor presentation, people are going to go elsewhere and they'll close down.
I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, but I can remember a time when you go to the cinema, the film had come out in the UK 6 months or even longer after it had come out in the States. The print I was watching had been around America 6 times and was scratched to buggery. Sound quality was appalling. The cinema floor was sticky. Things have changed completely, mostly thanks to Phil Sess of digital cinema. You now get releases that are simultaneous with the States. We're getting digital projection, so it's pristine every time. And you're getting fantastic digital sound. I mean, the improvements in cinema projection since I was a kid are just staggering. I hopefully had a glimpse 2 weeks ago at Dolby of where we're going in terms of the audio side of things. We've already seen where we're going in terms of 4K capture and maybe even higher resolution, you know, things like IMAX using higher film formats. We've seen an idea of where we might be going. I think it's really exciting.
That's our discussion of last month's podcast. We're going to get the guys back in again later in the new year, once this format is launched, because Atmos doesn't go out till the spring, and there are no Barco screens in the UK yet either. So it's going to take a few months for them to start their rollout. Public get to hear them and so on. And if you stay tuned to the forums, we may even have a special day out. It's yet to be confirmed, though, so I'm not going to say any more on that. But that's that conversation done. It is the end of the year. It's been quite a busy year. I mean, 2012 has just flown by. I don't know about you other guys, but it seems to be one of the quickest years ever, but also one of the busiest years ever for AV Forums in terms of reviews. Ed Selly came along this year, Ed, and you've added your headphone reviews, group tests and that kind of things. Russell's been busy with speakers and subwoofers, and Steve and Mark have been through every major TV this year. So let's talk about our favourite products of the year, and obviously the guys are going to have their favourites in the categories in which they review. But let's go to Russell first. Russell, it's always interesting to read your take on stuff that you get in for review, and certainly it's one of the more enjoyable experiences reading your reviews that I find, because when I get to the end of it, I want to buy the product. So you've looked at a lot of, let's be fair, high-end product this year. What were your favourites?
If I had to pick two favourites this year in terms of bang per buck performance, it would be an £800 5.1 surround sound package and a £999.99 5.1 surround sound package, just because they were the two that sort of defied expectations the most. And I'd be slightly hard-pressed to pick between them, but it would be the Q Acoustics Q7000 system and the Paradigm Cinema CT100 system for exactly those reasons. You sat these little things down, you listened to them, and you thought... In fact, Steve, you heard these at Bristol last year, the little Q Acoustics ones, didn't you?
I did.
And you sit there and you look at them and think, what the hell can come out of that? And it's fantastic.
Yeah, I didn't really believe you when I read your review, Russell, but then I heard them in action and thought, oh, actually, you've got a point.
Yeah, it's they're just very centre. I think part of it is because both of them have got very, very competent little subwoofers with them, which does help with scale an enormous amount. They are both sensibly engineered. They've both got nice refined little tweeters. So when you do crank them up a bit hard, they don't sort of get shouty and nasty and start to sound small and compressed too quickly. But they were, you know, when you get an 8-foot subwoofer in your front room, you've got to expect it to start rearranging giblets, flapping trouser legs, and things like that. But it's, the real surprise, I think, always comes from the cheap stuff. You know, it's what these incredibly clever people manage to do with a budget that I always find is one of the most fascinating things in this industry. And those two little systems, I wouldn't like to pick between them, to be perfectly honest, because they were sufficiently different enough in size to not really be quite the same market segment. But I'd either of those two, I'd pick as my products of the year.
So let's take it away from product of the year. And what was the big technical thing this year? What was the one product that came along this year and absolutely blew you away? And you thought, it changed your perception of things.
It probably was the Kreisel subs, just because, you know, you can quite easily drop. I say you can quite easily drop. You'd have to have it in the first place, I suppose. But you can quite easily drop 8K on a single subwoofer. And yet this offered a completely different way of skinning that particular cat. I think I mentioned in the discussion last month, it was modular. So you didn't have to drop it in one lump, which means you didn't have to trade in a sort of very expensive subwoofer and lose loads of money on it beforehand. You could build it up in chunks and just end up with outright, absolutely phenomenal performance. I mean, you could buy four of these things and park them in opposite corners of the room if you've got a room that'll allow it, and still get pretty much close to the same sort of level of performance. But I think that was probably the one that really, really blew me away, just because it just seems so utterly limitless in its capabilities.
Excellent stuff. So let's move to Ed. Ed, first of all, what was your product or products of the year?
Two different products stand out from the year's reviewing with AV Forums. The first, like Russell, one product that turned up where I had absolutely no preconceived ideas about what it was going to do, and was sort of bowled over by it from the moment I started using it, was the PSB headphones, the snappily named M4U2s. Because PSB have never built a pair of headphones before. On a personal level, I've precious little experience of using their speakers. But effectively, from the moment that you unbox them, the result, it's like looking at what happens when a group of incredibly focused people have clearly looked at hundreds and hundreds of pairs of other headphones and gone, what's wrong with these? What do we like about these? Where can we improve this? And the result is absolutely spectacular. They are exceptionally comfortable. They work beautifully in passive mode. Their active noise cancelling is the least intrusive I've ever used on any product. And it fundamentally, if you're looking to spend £300 on a pair of headphones, I don't honestly know of anything that gets within a country mile of them. They were simply extraordinary. The other product, which is a more recent sort of turnout, was the Name Unity Lite, which is the only product this year I gave a reference badge to, simply because, as I said in the review, not only is it the best all-in-one I've tested in the last 2.5-3 years, I'd be hard-pressed to recommend anybody a set of separates that did the same range of abilities for £1,600 that would be decisively better. And that's not unimpressive. £1,600, quite a lot of money, but nonetheless, I was absolutely blown away by it. It did 80-90% of what my £8,000 worth of Name stuff does, which might not be great news in an absolute sense for Name, but it's fantastic news for the consumer.
And like Russell, which product this year, in terms of technical advancement or just sheer pleasure, what is the one product this year that's really knocked your socks off?
There's two answers to this. In terms of technical advancement, it's been the trickle through from a number of products, both seen here, like the Unity Lite and other items, and elsewhere, where you can now listen to high-resolution audio. It's completely seamless. Controlled by iPad or iPhone, it's a completely different user experience to anything that's gone before for two-channel audio, and when it's done properly, it sounds absolutely superb. The other answer is a bit of an odd one. The most weirdly covetable thing that's gone through for AV Forums for me this year was when I did the iPod dot group test, the Revo Heritage. Now, I can't give it a product of the year in an absolute sense. It wasn't the best sounding product there, but it was easily the sort of coolest looking and most fun thing to interact with that I've used in a very long time. It's sort of one of those things where you think, I have no immediate use for it, but I just kind of want one anyway. And it was quite good news that in the great scheme of things that have that effect on me, at roughly, I think, £200, it's one of the less insane things for that to happen for. Completely beyond the realms of easy to explain sort of performance or functionality, it just had a want one factor that very few other products have.
And just before we finish on the audio side and go over to what Russell would describe as the boring video side of things, from both of you, Russell and Ed, what's the one bit of tech this year that's changed your life? It can be audio or anything else, but is there one bit of tech that's come along in 2012 and completely changed how you live your life? Let's go Ed first.
It's this industry finally getting its head round decent UPnP control apps, be they for two-channel or multi-channel product. I really don't want to go back to using remotes wherever I have to. They're just so inferior to the sort of two-way remote experience that, you know, you used to get in sort of embryonic form with Pronto and other sort of sophisticated remotes. It for me is the biggest leap forward, simply because it just makes good things better. And it doesn't have a particularly sort of esoteric buy-in. It should benefit a load of different people.
I think what's changed my life? Well, I'm sort of renowned as the technical Luddite, really, aren't I? So I'm a bit late to the party. I think the one thing that probably changed my life this year was the iPad 3, because it was a bit like Ed with his Revo, really. I'd seen them. I've had Apple products, their computers, the iPhone, things like that. But the first time I held one, I knew I was going to own one. Yeah. I didn't have a use for it. I've got a perfectly good laptop at home. But I've just found it's one of those things. I've just found so many uses for it. I mean, it's been the remote. It's the remote control for the music streaming devices. I've been using it to control an AV processor recently. I can go outside and use it as a star map. Hell, I can even drive telescopes from it wirelessly, which saves you tripping over wires in the dark. Is there anything you can't do with it?
And it's quite funny that our podcast, just before we went to the gadget show this year, we discussed the new iPad, and. Russell, you were along with me.
I think at this point you should probably replay that clip, and we all said unanimously, is anybody going to buy iPad 3? No.
Yeah,
hands
we all
up
said
how
no.
Many of us have now got iPad 3s?
Well, hands up is a bit pointless, but one sat next to me now, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to be honest and say I've got an iPad 2, not a 3.
I've got a Sony tablet, actually.
Get you.
Okay, so that's the audio. Okay, so that's the audio side of things. Let's move over to video and displays and Blu-ray players and so on. Russell falls asleep. But at this point, I guess we just have to say the Panasonic VT50, best TV of the year, and just leave it at that, Mark and Steve.
Well, that's
how
the year. Yeah, I'm going to say that. Well, we'll get to that, I guess. But it kicked off back in March with the VT50, which was a nice step up from the year before. In terms of everything, really. Better processing, better black levels, more contrast, more accurate colours through the range. Tons of features, some useful, some not. Lovely looking display. And it was the first one we gave reference, wasn't it? Nearly 4 years or so for a domestic display.
Yeah, and I think we can safely say 2012 was the year that Panasonic finally delivered on their promise.
Yeah, I think that's
which everyone's true. Been waiting for since the Kuro vanished from the market and Pioneer pulled out and some of the engineers went over to Panasonic. Everyone had been expecting them to suddenly deliver Kuro Mark II under Panasonic's name and didn't. It took time, I think. It took time for them to evolve the technology. But this year, I'd say personally, and I'm sure you'd agree, Mark, that they finally delivered on that.
Yeah, on all fronts, throughout the range, really. I mean, you wouldn't be ashamed of owning a down to an ST50 in your room, really, and even the UTs are pretty excellent if you can sit them in a room that's not getting a lot of light. But yeah, they're a cracking job. But then along came the Samsung plasmas, and they run them extremely close as well.
I've got to say, because I'd only just literally in the last week reviewed their 64-inch E8000, Very, very impressive TV.
Yeah, I think the thing with Samsungs is they just get better as they get bigger.
It's true, Mark. Yeah, for some reason, their performance seems to improve with size, as do many people, I believe. Also, bizarrely, their black level seems to get improved as the panels get larger. But the only thing about the Panasonic plasmas that you could hold against them, to be honest, is there is a bit of dynamic force contouring, DFC.
Yeah.
With motion, particularly like with faces and that sort of stuff, when they're large in this frame and they're moving across the frame or the camera's moving, you get some contouring around the skin tones.
They've definitely produced it this year again, but it's still definitely present as mentioned.
Yeah, and particularly if you're looking at it on a very large screen, it's the 65-inch ST or the 65-inch VT, clearly any kind of artifact is going to be amplified because of the size of the screen. Now, the Samsungs, of course, no dynamic force contouring.
Not that I saw.
No, very, very clean, very lovely. I mean, a really nice image. Okay, the blacks aren't quite as subterranean as they are on the VT, for example. And the design's not quite as pretty. It's still an attractive TV, but it does have that annoying quad foot. But you can pick it up for £2,200.
64-inch, that's the sucks. Yeah, ridiculous, isn't it?
So you've got to say that. And not only that, it also includes Samsung's smart TV platform, which is quite simply the best on the market. So you've got a pack full of features. It's got a built-in camera, which actually is really useful. I did Skype calls with my parents in Spain, and it's actually really cool just to be able to talk to them, when you're sat on the sofa. So that's something I actually would make genuine use of quite regularly. And I found myself thinking, if someone gave me one of these TVs, I'd be pretty happy about it.
They're not going to.
Probably, not going to. But it was one of the few occasions where, along with when I had the VT50, where I thought, well, I wouldn't miss the Kuro. I can't say, I can't get higher praise than that, really.
What's the price difference between 65-inch Panasonic and 64-inch Samsung, then?
About £800 between the VT and 50 and the E8000, although you can get the 65-inch ST50 for about £2,000, I think, on your mark.
Yeah, I think 1900 now. It's going end of line now, so if
you
pick them up now.
And that's one of the things that's overriding, sort of opinions I've made this year, is just staggering level of value that's out on offer there in terms of both audio and video. It's unbelievable. I think Russell alluded to it with his choices of 5.1 systems. What they can deliver now for the money is just quite incredible.
The problem is though that they're not making any money. That's a problem.
They slashed the margins to the point where they're all going under.
I don't think there's a single TV division making any money, and that includes Samsung, who sell the most, but their TV division isn't actually turning a profit.
Okay, so let's, and again, this is not the AV Forums Awards or anything like that, but this is more the personal choices of the reviewers here. But Steve, what would your TV of the year be?
Well, it's either... The VT50 is clearly the best TV that's been made, that's released this year, in terms of all-round performance. Looks, features, everything, design. It's an absolutely fantastic television. And, the first TV, as Mark said earlier, that I've had him for review where I've thought, okay, you can take the Kuro away now. I'll keep this. This will be fine, which is not normally the case. And I said that would be my opinion right up until 2 weeks ago. And now, just at the very end, Samsung has sort of snuck in there with what I think for all-round value terms, features, performance, looks, and apart from the quad foot and value in terms of price, just a very, very close second is the E8000.
Okay, and Mark?
And a complete mirror to that, the Panasonic VT50. Actually, I will plump, and I don't think Steve saw this one, was the E6500 Samsung plasma.
Just
for the value. Yeah, it's pretty similar to the E8000, as you can imagine, just a little bit cheaper, so great value and fantastic TV.
And of course, Steve, another area of the display market. Sorry, Mark, so you said the VT50 as well, just so we get that.
I did.
Okay. Right, so Steve, another area of the display market which we've been looking at, and of course, we're getting all the new models coming through now as the new year approaches, and that's the projector market. Being another year where advances have been made and the quality level in terms of value for money has gone through the roof again.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about this podcast and what projectors I would pick, I was really struggling because the level of performance and the value they offer in the sort of £3,000, £2,500, £3,000 price bracket. It's just incredible. I mean, there's, you know, you're seeing projectors now that are delivering performance that would have been, you know, undreamt of even 10 years ago, but now you're picking it up for $2,000. You know, you're getting CMSs in there, you know, color management systems, full calibration controls, 2D, 3D performance, bright bulbs, and you're paying $2,000. I mean, I reviewed the TW8100 from Epson, which is their new lineup this year was essentially the same as last year, but they've added one more projector that didn't exist last year, which is the TW8100, which is kind of like a slightly stripped down version of the 9000. I think this is becoming a bit of a trend because JVC are taking a similar approach themselves. And that was, you know, for I think just over £2,000, absolutely superb performance for the money. I mean, just incredible. That you wonder, I mean, you realize probably to a certain extent with someone like Epson, where economies of scale really come into play because they are the world's biggest manufacturer of projectors. And clearly they've got, you know, the build quality was excellent, but obviously they have these chassis being made en masse and they can afford to undercut the competition to a degree. And the same thing that we were talking about just now with the TV market is definitely applying in the cinema, in the projector market. Where you're seeing, you know, manufacturers in the lower price point, so the £3,000 below price point, and really are competitive. Now you've got Sony coming in with the HW50, which incorporates an awful lot of the technology that's in the VW1000, which I'll talk about a bit later on. You know, that's offering, and again, an amazing level of performance for what is a very, very competitive price. You've got Panasonic coming in with the PT86000, which is a sort of refinement of last year's PT85000, which you reviewed, Phil, so... I didn't actually see that myself, although I've seen it in demo, but didn't review it. Again, a very strong performer. And as you said, Phil, we are currently in the middle of reviewing the JVCs. And again, you know, with JVC, you've got the X35, which in terms of price point, very competitive price point. Although we haven't actually seen it yet, if it's anything like the performance from the 30 and the 3 before it, you know, it's got to be a strong contender. Because JVC, as well, anyone who's listened to our podcast knows, you know, in terms of black levels, they are pretty much the reference point. Well, they are the reference point. Again, the X55 is a new product for them this year, incorporating much of the features you'll find on the X75, the higher priced projector, but at a lower price point. So £4,999, you're getting CMS, you're getting eShift 2, which increases the resolution. Not a 4K projector, but it does increase the resolution that you don't actually see, although it still only accepts a 1080p feed. Again, superb blacks, a really big improvement in 3D performance from last year, I think, by JVC. So again, very, very strong range of projectors from them. You know, it makes choosing one almost impossible, I think, at the moment. It comes down to, in the end, what you want the projector for. If you've got a back cave, get a JVC. Because the black levels and the film-like quality of those projectors in the right environment is just second to none. If you're looking for more brightness, you might want to look at the Epsons or the Sony or even the Panasonic, because they've got the brightness to deal with a room where light control isn't so strong. Of the projectors I've seen so far this year, I'm going to go with the HW50.
Interesting choice there, Steve. Now, why have you picked that projector? Because a lot of people would be thinking, well, the JVC should be in there.
Yes, I think the JVC should, as I said, I haven't seen the X35 yet, so I can't actually add that to the mix. But the X55 is a superb projector. It is £5,000 though. You can get the Sony for less than three, and you're getting a CMS in there. Reality creation, now a bit of an acquired taste. It's basically a dynamic sharpening feature. So whether you like it or not very much depends on if you like that kind of thing. It's a bit like the Derby Darble. It's very much a Marmite product. It's quite effective, though, although it does look slightly processed, I think, to the more sort of tuned eye. But yeah, it just delivered a really nice image, really good image accuracy, loads of features, great competitive price point. I think Sony certainly, in the last year, really raised their game from previous couple of years where I think they got quite complacent. Certainly they were stung badly by the VW90, which had some pretty poor 3D. The HW50 has superb 3D as well, if 3D is a thing. So I think I'm going to go with that one. in light of the fact that we haven't finished reviewing all the JVCs yet.
Well, you might not have, but I have. and that's going to be my projector of the year, simply because it is a reference point, and that's the X75 from JVC. It is a £7,000 projector. It's not going to be for everybody. And to really get the best out of it, and that is the 90,000:1 contrast, which it mirrors pretty close to that in real life as well. JVC are quite conservative when it comes to their figures. So for me, the X75, I've just calibrated it up today, watched a few clips of videos, and it's been running for 67 hours just to put some hours onto the bulb, and I have watched a few films on it. And I've lived with the X90 most of this year, which was JVC's top-of-the-line projector last year, and I think the 75 gets up there with that, and it's $7,000. If you've got a Batcave, if you're dedicated to watching film, and you want the best sort of filmic analog type picture, which can be calibrated within an inch of its life, then the X75, and it's getting a reference badge. So that's my choice of the year. Now, technological prize of the year, guys. We've had a few sneak peeks of technology coming along, and one which got us really excited when we went out to Monaco, Steve, which was OLED, yet it's disappeared off the face of the planet.
Yeah, I mean, that was back in May, wasn't it? Yeah, it was back in May for the Monaco Grand Prix. So big launch for LG's OLED, 55-inch OLED TV. Looked awesome, didn't it? The blacks were just totally black. The dynamic range was incredible. It was bright. The colours burst off the screen. It was 4 millimetres thick. You thought, okay, so this is the future of TV. And then they just disappeared. Samsung was supposed to be releasing one as well. We haven't heard a peep out of either company since the summer. The reason for that would appear to be that the production yields are quite low, and they're struggling to actually produce enough of these TVs to sell, which has always been a problem with OLED. I thought they'd licked it. Clearly they haven't. And now we're hearing, you know, that we might not be seeing them until this time next year. So that's actually quite a big delay in terms of OLED, which gives higher resolution 4K panels, I think, a window of opportunity.
Is that a coincidence, do you think? Or do you think it's totally down to yields?
Well, I was just going to say, the cynics out there might say, well, hang on a minute, let's get our 4K TVs out before we release OLED.
I think they'll find selling 4K easier, because numbers are easy to sell, and telling the consumer that it's just got more resolution, higher resolution, you know, more pixels. You've gone from 2 million to 8 million, isn't it?
Yeah.
you've gone from 2 million pixels to 8 million pixels. That's pretty easy for marketing people to sell. Selling OLED is going to be pretty tricky, because they spent the last 5 years telling people that they're buying an LED TV, and they're not. They're buying an LCD TV with an LED backlight. Now they're going to say, oh, here's OLED. And they're going to say, well, hang on, haven't I got an LED TV? They may have shot themselves in the foot a little bit on the marketing perspective, which I'm sure isn't going to make selling a new product like that any easier. Plus, if I was being doubly cynical, I know for a fact that Phil and I have both seen screen burn on the samples at shows. Now, obviously, a TV left at a show is not the most ideal conditions. But if you're putting out a £9,000 TV and it burns, you've got problems. Because people may have put up with that on plasmas 10 years ago, but they are not going to put up with it now. Not with the internet. It'll just be bloody murder out there. So I can see OLED being a tricky sell, whereas I can see 4K being a relatively easy sell. You ties in with 4K cinema. It's big numbers, easy to sell. The big problem with 4K, obviously, is going to be how the hell you deliver that content into the home.
Yeah, and that's possibly one of the things we'll see at CES. Hopefully, a viable delivery system that isn't necessarily hard drive based. A simple disk based solution that people can grasp.
That's my dream, Mark. I'd really like to see.
It's probably not going to. We say it every year, don't we?
I want the disk based format, some kind of physical medium, to have one last hurrah before we all go to. Because I like to own something physical, and I don't want. I love Blu-ray, so some sort of ultra high definition Blu-ray would be my dream. And if I have to see one more smart TV at CES, I'm going to shoot myself. So hopefully there'll be something new out there.
Well, let's round this up very quickly because we are running out of time. And I guess the last thing to cover is technological achievement, whether it's a display, a source player, or some other product display-wise that we've looked at this year or reviewed this year. What would you be your choices? And I want to get in here first because I'm going to say the VW 1000. And the reason I'm going to say that, and I didn't review it, but I have seen it a few times now. The one reason I'm saying that is that Sony have got the balls to get out there and release this projector. It can take a 4K signal. It is a native 4K projector. Even upscaling Blu-ray onto it, it looks absolutely fabulous. And kudos to Sony for getting out there, because it will also take a Cinema DCI feed as well, Steve. And that's the holy grail when it comes to display.
Yeah, I mean, that projector is basically a cinema-grade projector released into the home, you know, as a consumer product. I mean, some people go, oh, it's £17,000. The fact that Sony managed to do that for £17,000 is frankly quite incredible. As you say, Phil, it's full DCI spec. It can do the full DCI 4K specification as well as the domestic, what's called Quad HD specifications. So slightly different resolution between the two, but basically they're essentially 4K. Can do either. It can do DCI color space. It could even do 48 frames per second if that ever happened. You know, it can do all of that. It's beautifully built. It's got a massive lens on it. Really nice piece of glass. It's pin sharp. The upscaling from Blu-ray looked superb. That's where Reality Creation really came into its own, because obviously you are scaling it up, so therefore you can use a bit of sharpening to match it to the high resolution panel. I mean, I was lucky enough to have this, you know, at home for a week. And it was, I mean, just an amazing project. Just as a technological achievement, it is second to none that Sony have managed to do that at all. And so, as you say, Phil, hats off to them for doing that and for leading the way in what I'm sure will become, you know, the 4K revolution that's coming.
Again, these are not the AV Forums Awards, so don't get carried away, listeners. These are the personal opinions of the reviewers here. But I think we've covered most of the products that really have impressed us this year. And I just wanted to end on just one special mention here, and we're going to special mention Sony again. And the reason for that, Steve, is that you went out to Tokyo back in February, at the beginning correct. Of the year, and they made all sorts of promises to you, Steve, when you were out there, basically saying that they were going to completely revamp the look at the market, they were going to improve the product, and they were really going to go for the kill. They were going to reduce the price of the products, but they were going to improve the performance. And I remember you saying to me at the time that it was an awful big thing to say then, and there was no way that they were going to be able to achieve that. But I think, certainly we've discussed two of the products tonight, and then if we look at the HX8 TV, they have kind of kept to their promise.
I was going to make mention of that in the roundup of the TVs of the year. It didn't quite make it in. It doesn't quite have the qualities of the plasma. But it did the basics really, really well. So there was great screen uniformity, good blacks. Even the local dimming was really impressive. We saw Steve and I earlier in the year happened to see a lineup of the current top-of-the-range LED crop against each other, and it was definitely the best in the dimming stakes. It was great. The only thing I didn't really like was the enforced speaker stand, which could possibly put people off. But it was great value, not a price that was, you know, way above everyone else like they used to be. They kind of seem to have lost that smugness, dare I say, a bit more realistic about the market.
Arrogance, to be honest.
Arrogance, yeah, both. Yeah, it was impressive. It just did everything really well.
No, I mean, I was absolutely right. Back in February, the head of the TV division for Sony worldwide, global head, literally put his hands up and said, you know, we dropped the ball. We dropped the ball in the last couple of years. They got complacent. They got arrogant. They were overpriced and they weren't particularly good. And he said, this year, we're going to change. We're going to turn it around. And as Phil said, I honestly think they really have. They've come out with some really, really good products at very competitive prices. They as typically for Sony, they looked great and they performed really well. They had fantastic feature sets. And I think if one company this year has really turned around from the last 2 or 3 years before, it's Sony.
Yeah, agreed.
So I guess if we're talking like that, Ed, Russell, has there been a similar story on your side of things?
Russell's experience with the Chrysler subs, where you can reach the high end through reach sort of high end performance through modular thinking, is that I have to be honest, there's not been anything
in the products that I've done for both AV forums and seen elsewhere this year, where I've really seen anything that revolutionary. From a personal level, the going back to the name, it's interesting that, as I said in the review, historically if you chose British Hi-Fi, you accepted that it either did something a bit weird when you used it, or it was made out of recycled bin bags, or you know, something equally unsatisfying. And they've built something which is, in terms of the way it operates and in terms of how slick it feels, it's the easy equal of any of the much more famed lifestyle brands, which I guess is an achievement in itself, but it doesn't really compare to someone getting a sensibly priced 4K projector out the door.
Now, the one thing I would say is that modular idea of system, actually, funny enough, is I was just thinking as you said that, I've sat in front of Name Systems, which have actually done precisely that, because they are one of the people where you can buy a preamplifier and then a better external power supply and then a power amplifier and then another one and then external crossovers and upgrade your speakers. And it's not necessarily a new idea, but it's refreshing to see it coming from somebody else.
In so much with the Chrysals that it's you buy one, if you like it, you don't buy an adjunct to that one product. It's not, you don't buy something different to enhance it. You simply start just, but it's like Lego. You just bolt an identical one on, which I think is just so refreshingly different as a take as to be worth celebrating.
Yeah, and it just does make me more interested actually to hear the little 8-inch driver ones as well, because that would take several feet out of the stack. It would be an altogether lesser imposing proposition and less expensive too. But I mean, there's still the potential with that many 8-inch cones flapping around. You're talking about the equivalent of what, 4 14-inch drivers in total, all stacked together. That's still going to have some serious output from a small subwoofer for sub 2K. So, yeah.
Well, it's been a fascinating year. It's been a quick year, like I said earlier on, but it has been a fascinating year. We really have covered a wide gamut of products this year. Also, with Ed joining the team as well, we've managed to move into other areas like headphones and so on. And thank you very much, listeners, for reading the reviews this year. Up until January, turn of the year, we'd done 248 reviews since we started reviewing. This year, we've done 190 reviews in the space of 12 months. So my thanks to the review team for working really hard this year. And basically, we're up 77% in 12 months. I think in any line of work, that's worth congratulating. And thank you for reading the reviews and leaving your comments and so on. And we promise you even more of the same going into 2013. We will be back with a podcast next month. It will be coming to you from CES. Steve and myself are lucky enough to go out for yet another year. We're looking for 4K to really make a move this year. Will we see OLED? Will we be given promises again that they can't keep? We'll keep you up to date. We'll be out there with the video cameras. Unfortunately, Mark's staying back in Macclesfield, but you're going to be updating this.
It's pretty glamorous, Macclesfield.
The Vegas of the North.
Don't laugh. You don't know.
Obviously, Mark's going to be updating everybody on the news as it's released, Mark, and we'll also have some live feeds from the press conferences and so on. So we will have the breaking news as it happens on the forums. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I'll be up all night for a while. So, as it happens. Yeah. Hopefully some people will stay up and read it.
So that's CES. CES kicks off, Press Day kicks off on the 7th of January, and then the show in full is from the 8th to the 11th. So we will have lots and lots of coverage from the show, so stay tuned for that, for all the latest news, all the latest products that are being released, and we might even try and get some audio in there to keep Russell happy as well. So that's about it for this year. So all we need to do now is wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
Season's greetings.
Merry Christmas, one and all.
I take it from Russell there, it was a bit of a bah humbug, but we are back next month. So tune in 21st of January for the Home Cinema Podcast. Also in January, on the 7th is the Movies Podcast, on the 14th the Gaming Podcast. Like I say, 21st for the Home Cinema Podcast, and the Podcast Extra is taking a holiday until February. So that's about all we got time for tonight. So my thanks to Steve, Russell, Ed and Mark.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
Cheers, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
And this is Phil Hinton saying thanks for listening. Have a great Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we'll see you in January.
The AV Podcast was presented by Phil Hinton. Original music by Andrew Bassett and Richard Cosgrove.
The AV Podcast was mixed and produced by Phil Hinton, and the senior producer was Stuart Wright. All content, including sound clips and music, is copyright material and featured for promotional use only. The AV Podcast is copyright M2M Limited.